Man, I just casually told you about $600 worth of stuff.
It's time to forge the narrative.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Forge the Narrative. My name is Paul, your host. I'm joined tonight by Red Powell.
Hello.
Adam Camilleri.
Hello.
And Tanya Gates.
Hi, everybody.
How are y'all doing tonight?
Fantastic. How are you, Paul?
I'm not too bad. You cannot believe what happened in Warhammer 40K last week. They updated the power level for several.
No comment.
No, we did. We got some pretty big facts coming out, that had come out, and there are some changes in here that are beyond cosmetic, that actually change how we experience match play games. I think there's some good stuff here that we'll all get behind if we haven't all yet. And then there's some stuff that's a little bit controversial,
as is tradition.
Yeah. Where do y'all want to start?
I want to start with a good one.
Let's do
back end scoring. Back end scoring for the player who goes second. I love it. Big fan.
So if for those longtime listeners, I'm actually a huge fan of scoring at the beginning of the turn. I think that it keeps a certain pace and aggression to the game that was missing from previous editions. And when I say that, a whole lot of things were going on. You know, armies certainly had mobility advantages over others. The game was different there. You know, there was a lot less parity and balance in some of the factions. So yep. the game has changed a lot. But I've still, you know, like the aggressive play. And I think that this change allows that aggression to occur, keeps the pace in action. Like, you know, the first turn is no longer a loading screen. Maybe it is between two equally matched players, but it's no longer, you're playing the game from before the first roll in this edition. And then this is keeping that thrill all the way to the end. There are, I think, going to be fewer foregone conclusions about how the game's going to play out because of this change.
Well, I've been smashing the games out now. Like, I think only a couple of weeks ago, I hadn't even played 10, and now I've almost doubled that. And I can tell you, like, I don't know if everybody else at home or you guys, but most of the time, first turn is pretty much a little bit of a non-event, less so now than ever before, pretty much in the game. Because I'm 5th edition, 6th edition, 7th edition, first turn, you, like, jostled for position, and then you went for it from there. This game, straight go ham straight away. But I found that turn 5, even in a 5-turn game, it just didn't matter. The scoreboard was already decided, or there was, you know, the player going first had already scored, and then all they do is just run off all the objectives and then just deny the player going second. And it was just a bit of a pain because, you know, start of your turn, start a player 2's turn, on the turn 5 happens, they already score their points, and then everything's already decided from there. You don't even need to play the turn. And I find that frustrating. I don't want that to be a thing.
Do you think that's happening?
I thought that was happening before, but I think this is a great change. I think this is a phenomenal change for getting rid of that out of the game, and I love it.
Yeah.
Is that your experience, guys, though? Like, in your games, you find this, like, turn 5, like, as a player going second, just doesn't seem to matter that much?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's been a pretty wide concern and issue with it. And I'm with you, Paul. I really like the scoring at the beginning because of exactly like you said, the momentum of it. I think that has a lot to do with the decision-making, because when you go into it, you understand that you're making a decision, you're going for an objective that has to endure your opponent's turn. And I think that's huge. And so, but I do think that this flip on the final turn gave a little more weight. I think it was pretty clear as people laid it out, and I don't have the data in front of me, but I'd be interested to see the numbers of what it looks like as far as with folks that went second and how that played out and just how much of was the disadvantage that people feel is there, was that actually there in the aggregated data? I'd be interested to see that for sure.
So I've seen some portion of the data, naturally with this edition being a little bit compromised because of Rona and whatnot. The data isn't extensive, but there is a slight, so we know there's a slight win chance in somewhere in the realms of a 10% extra win chance, 60% to 40% for going first or second. Whether that breaks down into like significant changes in primary scoring, which I think is the big concern. The big concern is that the player goes second, goes first, gets the better of the primary.
Well, I mean, that's the bulk of your quote unquote, easy to get points. Where yeah. You need very much, very little cooperation from your opponent typically to get those points.
Mm, exactly right. But yes, I just love this change. I think it's really good. I think they did it in a way that's elegant and doesn't feel clunky. So essentially, like on the last turn of the game, player two essentially plays what they would have played, you know, has end game objectives for that turn. Everyone remembers, what was it called? The ITC mission for holding at the end of the game? Ground control.
I knew it.
Yeah, ground control. I love that one. Oh my gosh, yeah. I love that objective.
But before that, that was just a mainstay objective from GW. You know, who holds the table better at the end of the game just gets points. And it was just part of their rule set for the longest time. So I'm happy to see a little bit of that come back. Because, I mean, I'm not sure if I miss it or if I'm just programmed to want to play like that after 10 years of playing the game like that. I am broken.
Let me read this out just so, again, I probably should have at the beginning. But primary objectives, take and hold, and domination. Add the following to the end of every primary objective in this mission pack. In the fifth battle round, the player who has the second turn does not score any victory points at the end of their command phase, but instead, at the end of their turn, they score 5 victory points for each of the above conditions that they satisfy for a maximum of 15 points.
Yep, perfect. Very well worded as well. There's no ambiguity there. I feel like there's not going to be any arguments either, which is nice.
Yeah, it's a good change. I mean, this is something I think is going to, you know, basically keep the fun in it for the perception of a disadvantaged player through the whole game.
Well said.
Just got to make it to turn 5 with some models left and you'll be just fine.
I mean, it's harder for some people than others looking at my Astra Militarum Codex.
No. So another big change is the determine first turn rule. So this is now the player, instead of getting a choice, the players roll off, the winner takes first turn.
Yeah, no ifs, no buts, no decision making involved, just roll, and if you win, you have to go first. How do you guys feel about this? I feel like someone else should go before I do.
I have like mixed feelings about it.
Yeah, go ahead.
So I like it because I think a lot of people bank heavily on going first or second. And I think it'll make you sort of deploy like more defensively if you were going to deploy aggressively or vice versa. But I don't like it because I think like it takes a bit of the like tactical decision away from you at the beginning of the game. So yeah, I'm kind of like, I'm neutral on it because it's like equally good and bad to me.
Red, what do you think, man?
Yeah, so I kind of wish that there was, because there's a lot of initiative to be taken one way or the other in the beginning. And we're playing a game that's inherently tactical in its scale and level, right? And when I say tactical, I mean like, so understanding, I view it in three levels, warfare of tactical, operational, strategic. And there's a whole debate. You can go into grand strategy. You can go into, you know, is there even, some people would argue there's no such thing as operational. But I mean, again, I'm going off the path here, but the tactical piece, when we come down to it, I mean, you know, the deployment, there's so much that goes into it when we get to these ranges and everything. And that's why I'm a big fan of ninth. And I know, Paul, you're going to talk more about terrain later, but, you know, with terrain and how it gets set up and how kind of the overarching thing is that when you start the game, you have conducted your initial maneuver and that is your deployment. And terrain should be set up in such a way because, for the most part, you know, assuming that we're both rational actors, why would I maneuver into no man's land at the beginning of a conflict, right? Like, why would I realistically start off where you can just shoot me off the table right out the get-go? That's a little different when you consider, you know, weapon systems that ignore line of sight, so on and so forth. But for the most part, you should be able to get out there and do that. Now, I think that, again, going back to it, I think that we can all kind of agree there's something to being able to get that initial hit in, right? That alpha strike. And so there's a whole other element to building an army, making sure it's resilient enough so you can endure and come back with, you know, what you might call a beta strike kind of deal. But when it comes down to that role and it's just here it is and there it is, it's decided and you lose degrees of agency to it. Because, you know, we don't have that. I kind of liked when we were going back and forth between the two types of deployment. And I know that's no longer really in there either, because I liked the variance to it, because tactical scenarios typically, you know, they're not just rote simulations over and over and over again. So I appreciate some variance to the tactical scenarios. And when it comes down to the first player, I'm also of the not so popular opinion that I liked seizing. I liked the 16% chance that someone could, you know, upset the layout, I guess.
Oh, man. Here's and where so I have to depart.
I know. Just put me back in my corner. I know.
Yay, it wasn't me. Yeah.
I know. I'm sorry.
Well, I mean, with some of this stuff, it's like, so I won the role, but I still lost the decision? Like, what? It's some of your points. I think of 40K, and not that I know you, or at least I don't feel like you believe this, but it's a complete abstraction. You know, we're really just looking at a situation, you know, as it occurs, it has to play out in a game format. So you're not really out there in no man's land because you made a poor tactical decision. It's just a function of the game kind of thing. You know, it's happening sure. in the abstract of the game.
Sure. And I'm with you on that. It has to be abstract because it is a game at its base level. However, what I would argue is what there's a distinction between game and war game, and that now they all vary, right? Like, I mean, you look at some of the elements of, if you go to Axis and Allies or something like that, and go to some of these other historical games, I mean, everything has its own different levels of abstraction. And so I agree. Like, I mean, you have to acknowledge and accept, because if you were playing something that was more realistic, I mean, you just add on that much more complexity every time you try to get closer to reality. And then is it even a game anymore? Right. And so I'm with you. I know that there was a lot of feel bads associated with seizing. I think that part of that, you know, again, tactical scenarios and these situations, it's just, a great number of varied iterations is essentially what each of our games are, because you're still playing in the same, you know, dimensions. I don't know if you've seen it. Have you guys seen the Open War cards? Have you guys seen those?
I've seen them. Yep.
Yeah. I highly recommend checking them out. I think that, again, you know, for those of us looking for some of that variance, the Open War cards have some awesome, excellent little things that can add that element. You remember how they used to, you know, I think 6th edition, I mean, plenty of editions, but 6th edition was a good one because it had it. I know it was baked into the back of the big rule book, like battlefield effects and things like that. All just cool stuff that added to it. But I totally understand. Don't get me wrong. Where my personal preference is, I totally understand where the greater good is.
I've had some epic seizes, you know, where I've certainly seized on folks and then proceeded to, you know, have it not go well for them. I just feel like I was on a disproportionate recipient of those also. So it just feels like it, you know.
Yeah, I suppose I'm with Red. I like the way he said the loss of agency. I feel like that's how I feel. I think there was some element of stripping back 8th edition from 7th. I mean, 7th edition had gotten clunky and cumbersome and very, very hard and intimidating for new players to pick up. I can tell you, like, so many of my mates, once they mastered 7th edition, didn't move on to 8th edition because they're like, we don't want to, it took us so long to learn this that they're playing Horus Heresy now. Like, that's the thing. But, you know, horses for courses. But I found it really interesting that I feel like 9th got a little more stripped back again. I mean, the making the table smaller took away a lot of tactical nuanced choices in some realms, because if people at home feel the same way as I do, that the movement phase is the most important phase, a smaller table, less options, less movement. But at the same time, like, we lost a lot of the abilities we had to trap and the nuance of the a lot of the combat phase that we had, which was admittedly, like, these were feel bad elements of the game that I'm not unhappy to see gone. But, you know, can't admit that is a whole facet of and skill set that people mastered in order to play the last edition that's now no longer relevant. And now we've got 5 turns instead of 6. Again, a whole sixth of the game is gone, a whole another turn of choices stripped away. And this one, I don't know. I don't think I'm going to miss this. Like, 6 months from now, I think I'm going to think, oh, yeah, everything's fine. Where I think it's going to bother me is the fact that every time I build a list now, I have to build it to go second. I don't have the option. I don't have the thing of, oh, yeah, cool, I can build an Alpha Strike. I can put my stuff on the line. You're never going to risk it anymore. Anyone's going to take a one dice bet that they lose 50% of their army turn one because they lost the roll. Everyone's just going to... I feel like a lot of builds for certain armies are going to be non-viable now. Because
you're going to go first half the time. Like, what are you?
Well, but are you going to, you know, in a six, let's say, well, I am speaking as a competitive player here. This won't be information that's universally good. But I'm not going to take a chance. If I'm playing in a 6-round tournament and if I want to win it, I'm not going to take a chance that I'm going to lose a dice roll and thereby lose a game. I'm just going to play defensive and make a defensive army.
Yeah, you make a list that can endure it, but I mean, you still will go first sometimes.
Absolutely right. Yeah, and sometimes I'll deploy defensively because I don't want to risk the dice roll. Then I'll win the dice roll and regret deploying defensively, you know? Yeah. So yeah, it's you know, glass half full, glass half empty. It depends how you want to see it. But that's I think it's going to be fine. 3 months, 6 months from now, I'm not going to care. But right now, I'm like, oh, I had all these lists in Battlescribe. I'm just going to delete them, or the app.
So I guess we'll get into some of the FAQ for the codexes and stuff changes. But one of the funniest comments that I saw when the facts hit was, you know, somebody said, my army didn't change at all. Does that mean my list is bad?
So I will say about the Space Marine changes, I find them interesting because they're the stuff that was good probably 3 months ago, 6 months ago, 9 months ago.
Especially, I mean, that's not true. So the thing like with the ATV guy is out.
You know? Praise be. that is gone. That was so silly. But the fact that they upped the points on Eradicators but didn't up the points on Attack Bikes with Multi-Melters, because that has been the competitive pivot. People have realized, oh, wait, Attack Bikes and Eradicators around the same points, do the same thing, but the Attack Bike has movement, whatever.
Better triple, movement.
Quadruple the movement.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, this is just better. So things like that, you can tell this wasn't super recently written, which is good. It shows the GW's, you know, still working with some forethought and that Corona hasn't completely shut down all their production and deadlines and stuff. But yeah, the same thing with Vanguard veterans. Vanguard veterans seem to be everywhere and super, super ultra powerful. And yeah, they didn't get touched, but a couple of other things did.
Just a devil's advocate is that things can be good. Like things can still, they can exist and be good. They don't necessarily have to. They could just be functioning correctly as, you know, as intended.
Just as in, exactly right. And so, yeah, I do think that all the things that got hit should have been hit. I think all these are spot on. Then maybe they could have gone a few more, but you know, I'll take what it is. Pretty happy with it overall.
Yeah. I think it's a constant work in progress too, but I like the willingness to adapt things and points and stuff where there may be a need to balance them out. But again, I'm a strong believer that things can be good and powerful. Not everything is just a zero-sum unit, you know, just because you have one thing that's really good, you don't have something that's really bad. Things can just be really good and things can be okay and different degrees of error all around.
That's well said. Did anybody's lists from the four of us get hit or changed dramatically?
Man, increased cost for Inceptors.
It was always going to happen. Surely, yeah.
I just don't think heavy bolter Inceptors were the huge problem, though. Although they are, I mean, it's the Inceptor squad has a lot of advantages to it. I'm actually taking it for all the other advantages, and now I just have to pay a little bit more for them.
I do agree with that. I think that they should have added it to the plat. But see, is there a movement away from that? Is a movement away from adding points to war gear? It seems like the chassis, the units themselves are absorbing the vast majority of the points costs now.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's okay. You know, especially if you move to a more streamlined thing to where, you know, you are like stealth moving us towards power level, but still hanging points on it.
Yeah, I don't think it's a bad thing. That's just something I've noticed.
Yeah. I like the flexibility to be able to build a kit however you want when you get it. And there not being a clear advantage to one thing or the other. So you never use those parts. And then you're forced like me to keep those parts forever for, you know, the time and when you will need them. I don't know what the answer is.
Did anybody, only the Inceptors from the armies that you're thinking of taking with Blood Angels got changed dramatically? Anybody else?
So Outriders also got the increase in points. And I think that the Outrider is a great unit. I mean, I think that point for point, the 5 extra point you're paying for the Outrider, if you were taking Outriders already, you're going to still want them.
Yeah, you'll just absorb that change. It's not going to break the bank, is it?
Yeah, and not for what they do. I mean, they're a great. I have not been using them recently because I feel like they're really great at killing like infantry, and everything in your army is already good at killing infantry. Everything in the Blood Angel army is already good at killing infantry.
Fair.
So do you guys just all play Space Marines?
I play Space Marines, Guard, and Custodes, and hopefully Knights soon. But yeah, so I'm
Well, because as somebody who whose main armies are not Space Marines, I would have a really hard time telling new players to start off with a, like, if somebody came to me right now and was like, I want to start a new army and I want to pick something that's not Space Marines or Necrons, I would tell them to probably save their money. I would tell them start Necrons or Space Marines, or save your money and get the new codex, because in my Guard codex, I basically had to reverse engineer every single entry to figure out what is free and what I have to pay for. And that's fine. Like, I know my codex fairly well, but like, new players aren't going to know that. So like, either they wait or they have to buy the app. Do you know what I mean? And like, yep. it kind of just feels bad as somebody with an old codex and a non-Space Marines army, that it took me like a few hours basically to find out how this codex works with points now.
So can you explain that? Sorry, when you say reverse engineering, you had to jump back from the document to the back and forward, back and forward, back and forward.
Right. So for example, Lehman Russ battle tank, when you look on its, any of the variants, when you look on the actual like data sheet in your codex, it says that it comes with a battle cannon and a heavy bolter, right? And then if you look through the first like paragraph of the points changes errata, it says that basically if like that weapon is not in the new entry with like all the weapon options, that it's included in the cost, right? Well, a Lehman Russ has a hull mounted heavy bolter on it, but the heavy bolter is in the points cost because it has side sponsons, right? And then you also have to reverse engineer the Lehman Russ to find out which turret is included in the points cost, right? Because it lists a few and it doesn't list the one that it came with in the codex. You have to pay extra for that one. So which ones does it come with? Well, I have to reverse engineer it with the book to find out what it comes with.
Okay, I get you.
The Guard are pretty complex army, though, with all the options. I mean, I was going to say Swiss Army knife, but I love maybe a little bit too much on the nose. They do have a heck of, I mean, I love playing Guard too. Like, the Catechins, I cannot wait to get them back on the table as well.
It's just a really easy fix to release an errata at the same time. And until those erratas come out for the Codex, I would just never suggest that a new player start this army.
Well, so actually I had something similar, but admittedly like less long time frame. People saw the changes to the rack points and the Reaver Jetblacks from Dark Elder, which are very exciting if true. Not quite sure I can be convinced that they're true just yet. I feel like they've got them switched. The Hellions mm-hmm. and the Reaver Jetblacks, I feel like those are the wrong way around. Mm-hmm. Yet to be confirmed. We'll have to wait and see on that. But 8-point racks. Like, holy crap, that is a freaking bargain for a 4+ invulnerable save with Prophets of Flesh. There's and all so the other layers of buffs.
Racks are so good.
Yeah, man. So one of my mates was like, hey, Adam, you think I should run out and buy like 150 racks? I'm like, nah, dude, stop. Codex is coming out next month. Do not go crazy and drop like $700 on it. Wait till you see the Codex, please. For the sake of,
Harlequins remain pretty much untouched, except they got kind of a buff with being able to get additional command points.
Yeah, they're an interesting one.
I mean, Harlequins have been, like, they're a finesse army for sure. I mean, I know they pack a punch, but you're still dealing with a limited number of people, you know, models, T3. You're putting a lot of faith in your own tactics and dice. But command points, you know, still people have got a bunch, and they're a command point thirsty army. And the player of the Twilight rule was add the following to the end of this warlord trait. The limit of gaining or refunding one command point per battle round does not apply to any command points gained via this warlord trait.
Pretty big.
Yeah. It's, I mean, anything that, you know, you talk about a 5-turn game and, you know, shorter or whatever, but if there's an army that can burn through command points, it's some of these more finesse-y type armies that have a little bit of age on the CP points, you know, of things for their codexes, for sure.
Yeah. The Harlequins one I thought was already a thing. I thought that was already confirmed to be in the game, but I guess they just needed to double down and confirm that they can get more than one back if they roll high enough.
Well, it's all these things in the codexes they'll be, you know, look, I think some of us, we can look at it and think, yeah, that's the intent. And then some of us are completely wrong when we say that, but we, you know, there's still an intent versus hard code things in the game. And there's been a stance pretty strong across the board of that you only get one back per turn.
Yep.
So and this removes all doubt.
Literally, I think Trajan Valoris is one of the only ones who gets by that now as well. So it's pretty spicy that Harlequins get that. The other big winner was Custodes. If you guys weren't aware, Custodes got a swathe of changes, all pretty much down across the board, which I think is really exciting for him.
What's standing out to you?
Bikes down by 10 points each. Custode Guard, I think, was down by 7 points a pop, which is quite exciting because you can just get more Custode into your list. Same with, I think, Alaris went down by 5 points a pop. This is all anecdotal off the top of my head, by the way. This is just what I remember me and my mates were talking about. But the
I'll pull it
the
up bike, and check. Hey, I'll
the bike is for bikers going down 10 points a pop is actually really, really cool. A lot of people were looking at like sideways at the bikes, like being like, they might be really good again soon. And because it's a really funny thing where the bikes hold up very well against Harlequins. Like nothing wastes Harlequin. Like you got 10 Harlequin troop with minus a billion to hit and all these other junk. He's just a bucket of shots that are going to hit on twos or threes at worst, you know, and just pepper them down. On top of that, they dodge the haywire. They're quick enough to engage on their own terms. A lot of really good things going for the bikes, but the problem is they're just way too many freaking points. It's like 3 units of 3 bikes, half your army. Congrats. Then they're probably not going to do half your army's worth of work.
I like what you meant there, what you said with getting the. You often don't find points to get the cool suite upgrades because your stuff's so expensive. Mm. You know, if you discount on some of this stuff, then it really helps you get some of those things that give you a little bit of edge in certain matchups.
Well, I felt for a long time, I've written a lot of custode lists in the last little bit, and I'd always felt like they were missing like one more unit to round them out. And maybe this is it. Maybe now with these changes, they get that last unit in. They feel like a truly well-rounded list, 2,000-point list, because I think that's where they were. They were like, oh, cool, you had your semi-meaningless troops choices that are all costing you 100 and a bunch of points for your 3, you know, custode guard. And then, yeah, you just had a, you know, maybe one big hammer unit, a second big hammer unit, and then just some misc stuff around it. Just never felt like you had enough army, especially now with objectives being what they are. You just feel like you'd... Well, the thing is, you need to your 2 HQs and your 3 troops for your, or your, you know, your one and one for a patrol, or 2 and 3 for a battalion. You take a battalion, it's usually like a third of your army just to fill out a battalion, pretty much at the cheapest you can do it. You know, taking Valoris, maybe a dude on a captain on bike, and then just three times three guard. It's kind of a crappy place to be starting.
I mean, crappy for the amount of durability and resiliency that they bring into a game that just changed its entire focus towards holding objectives. Mm-hmm. I mean, they got a lot going for them. Don't get me wrong. And they really got a good pat on the back with this last round.
Yeah, exactly right. I think the missions are all of a sudden in a good place for them to really contest and get stuck into them. But I mean, the issue is, I don't actually think they're that resilient for their points anymore. With the way Space Marines have gone, with the way Necrons have gone, with Necrons getting guys back and having invulns on stuff that usually doesn't have invulns and master wounds.
They leveled out a little bit. I'll agree to that. Yeah.
I mean, they're still absolutely, like, you look at a Custode Guard and anything Eldar can get for the points and you're like, oh, that feels good. But then you say, is a Custode Guard or for 20 points less, here's a Blade Guard veteran. And you're like, yeah, that feels really bad.
I don't want to make it sound like everything in the Guard Codex is bad because my list went down like 145 points or something like that. Thank you.
It's a brand new shiny new Lehman. So you don't have to, there you go.
I've really been holding back. I'm sorry. I don't want to jump on the guard, but like, it's hard for me to contain my excitement. I know you guys can hear it in my voice. Because, I mean, you mentioned, Tanya, the Necrons, and when you tell me that I've got 80-point reanimators, oh my goodness. I've been running baseline 60 warriors, and now I'm going to include, so before they were 110 points, now they're 80 points. I'm totally going to run 3 of them. And that makes warriors reanimate on 4s and they reroll 1s.
Yuck.
Oh, man. I'm excited. I'm super excited.
I think that what GW did with the Guard Codex, it was very smart because in general, Guard lacks resiliency and like the only unit that we have that can really sit on objectives with any real hope to hold them is Bulgrins. So that was the main change in this codex, right? It was the Bulgrins went down like 7 points each or something like that.
They're now ridiculous. So they're now the same points as a bunch of other comparable slots, which I think is very cool. E.g. Breaches, Admech Breaches, 35 points a pop. Also Beast of Nurgle, 35 points a pop. So pretty much all, apart from the Breaches, you know, two elite slot things, high durability, don't do a lot of damage anymore. Like a Bulgrin, you know, it will happily munch on intercessors and stuff, but the amount of stuff that they can usually realistically expect them to just punch straight through has gone down a lot. Still very good. I'm at 35 points a pop. I'm taking a bunch. I'm even considering three units of five, like to just be three little nodes of please don't come here. It might be bad. We'll see. Maybe in the future, possibly deterrent. Yeah. As good a deterrent as you're going to get for guard, you know?
Yeah.
That's not bad. Can we move over to the main rule book?
I got to tell you, I'm just going to say it again. Reanimators, man. Reanimators. All right, now let's move on to the main.
God, I got to paint some of those for my buddy. I'm sure now.
You better.
Yeah. Well, I was going to talk about the embark kind of change here.
Oh, yeah. The phasing of it. They adjusted. I mean, they clarified, I guess, the how exactly and when you can embark.
Well, and then also what affects what, that's kind of the thing. So, yeah, out-of-phase rules and embarking on transports, we'll start there. We wish to add an example that explains how out-of-phase rules apply to units. When a unit uses a rule to make a move as if it were a movement phase, all normal rules that would apply in the movement phase apply when making the move. For example, models in that unit cannot finish that move within engagement range of any enemy models. And if every model in that unit finishes a move wholly within 3 inches of a friendly transport model, they can embark within that transport model, following the normal movement phase rules regarding embarkation. For folks that needed that, there you go. And then going on with the embark, change the second sentence to the second paragraph to read, unless specifically stated, other units' abilities have no effect on units while they are embarked, and stratagems cannot be used to affect units while they are embarked.
Yep, so even if you got open topped, you can't, you know, give them rerolls or burst into the long war or anything like that, which I think was in the last FAQ. Sorry, in the previous edition, but it might have been one that got dropped in the transition.
Yeah, it was a matter of just the translation and changing over from 8th to 9th, and somehow it kind of fell off and there was the question, and it was merely something that I feel a lot of us were okay, you know, we're just going to keep going with what we had because it did need an FAQ, and I just appreciate the fact that they FAQ'd it just to really sink in the clarification there.
Yeah, I appreciate it too. The other one in the main rulebook that I think might have gone a little bit by the wayside, like I'm not sure everyone's really noticed, but warp time, double moving powers now. Anything unless you move twice, you cannot advance unless it specifically says that you can. Like for the one that comes to mind is the Raven Guard one that says, you know, if you haven't already advanced, you may advance with this second move. But that means warp time says you can't do the double move. So a lot of people were over down here. Quite a few people were using Fabulous Bill, and he was they have a move in advance and then a plus one to the move in advance and stuff like that. As people using that to just slingshot a unit of 20 possessed into you turn one and just kind of make your life really unhappy.
Seems a little inconvenient.
But, slightly inconvenient. But yeah, that kind of put that one to bed because now they can't double advance. And, you know, an extra potential 7 inches off their total move is going to make a big difference when it comes out in the wash.
I'll mention one more thing here. This is in the Marine, not the core rule book, but with clarifying, you know, if something counts as if you were in that phase or whatever, then you get all the rules, and that includes their super, chapter doctrine abilities.
Yep.
So there's been some debate about that, you know, whether or not the timing of which things activate kind of thing. If you counted to be in the assault phase but weren't in the assault phase, then there was some opinion, and with grounds, that maybe you did not get the benefit of that super ability unless you were actually in the correct phase, but that's been removed. The doubt has been removed.
Yeah, I think it was almost assumed you would, but GW did need to say, like, all the things for, because even you had these questions for Blood Angels with the Savage Fury. If you get wound back to Tact Doctrine with the is it Sang Priest?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The Red Grail legend. Yep.
Yeah. What do you get? What are you giving up? Et cetera.
Yep. I mean, I think that's the way that it was intended to be, and I'm glad to see it stood up and it's been clarified.
Yeah,
not just because it's powerful, but I mean, for it's not just Blood Angels either. It's when it comes up for other people with these such abilities, and I think we'll see more of them I think we'll see a doctrine style thing through more codexes that it will. We now know how it works.
Agreed.
Hey, let's take a break if we can. We'll come back, talk a little bit about the terrain thing that we mentioned about, you know, what's the, how do you get started with terrain? I'd like to point out that I'm now going to be a pro painter because I have myself a Winsor & Newton Series 7 brush. I'm kidding.
Hashtag.
I'm not kidding about having the brush.
Changer.
About the impact, but like when do you splurge on things? That's something I want to discuss after the break. See you in a minute.
FTN is brought to you by Discount Games Inc. Please visit them at www.discountgamesinc.com. And don't forget to ask Jay about ways to save even more on your hobby projects.
Hey everybody, we are back. I still got Adam and Red here.
Hello.
And Tanya Gates.
Hello.
So thanks for joining us again after the break, coming back. At some point, sometime soon, I'm going to have a cool segment to introduce into the show. I don't want to jinx it by saying what it is, but you might have just heard it if I got it done. If not, then next week or soon. No, I know it's vague, but you know, hey, you might have just heard it. I might not be hinting at anything at all. Last week we started talking about like Necromunda terrain. I've got some cool thing for my, some cool ideas for my Underhive. I actually posted a couple of things on Instagram using some relics of a dark age. The old bulkheads that came out with the original Necromunda set, and then also the cardboard terrain that GW put out for a while.
I loved it. I thought you did a great job on it.
Thank you.
See the paint on it.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. I came into possession of several of those bulkheads. Then I used some Plasticard, and was it Plastruct is the name of the brand? And I was getting their ribbed roofs.
That's ribbed, you say?
Yeah, I know. I'm enjoying it. Corrugated, ribbed. That's the thing. If you look for it, it's ribbed roofs. And that stuff is not cheap either. So I really can't suggest this is like an alternative for, but it's going to, it gives you a specific effect. And that's what I'm going for. And I'll show you, I'll build it out as we go. And we got a cool question on a comment on YouTube. Was like, yo, where do I get started with getting terrain for my table? Like, how do I go into this? And so I thought it'd be a good like exercise of like, because once you've got your army, once you've put your army together, you've painted your army, and however long that took you, it's some amount of time, and it's a long time and a lot of effort. You still got to get it on the table and play. So how do you get going with terrain? So immediately I started looking like, well, huh. So I think you probably need one or two Sector Imperialises. You need maybe one Derelict Factorb. It's bigger than the picture it looks. You probably want an Imperialis Administratum and then a Manufactorum by itself. And then, you know, maybe you want some scattered terrain. So you want to get a section of those crates, the battlefield crates. Oh, and that Mechanicus Ferotic Furnace looks awesome. It's actually a very versatile kit because if you put it next to the two plasma generators, you can make like a little power output thing and it blocks line of sight. It's great. And I'm like, man, I just casually told you about $600 worth of stuff.
An easy $600. Like, whoa.
I don't think it's quite that much. And I kind of went a little bit on an embellished tear there. But you could, not only that, but once you get those kits, you then have to assemble them. You then probably want to paint them and get them going. I think if you were to compromise your hobby in any stretch the terrain is where the terrain going, getting into the game before you've even decided if you really like it. Like if you're an enthusiast that wants to have three or four different tables that you can rotate through on your own personal table at home, you know, compromise on this. Okay, let's say you get all that stuff. You don't have to paint it getting out, right off the jump. I am a bit of an army painted snob, but I'll let you get by on the terrain.
Well, it's just accepting that everybody starts somewhere.
Yeah.
Right? Like nobody starts with just this full blown, like, boom, I can set up four, five, six different tables or whatever. It's definitely a work in progress and not something to like really sweat bullets over, I guess.
Yeah. Terrain, it's a function. Like you need it to enjoy the game. You know, let's say Red, you're playing a shooting army and I'm playing a walking assault army with no vehicles. Like the only prayer I have of having and enjoying this game is if there's some terrain on the table. So you have to have it. Yeah.
It's true.
So what when I instead of coming at it, this is about like what to buy or how to buy things or encouraging, people to spend one way or the other, especially when times are what they are. I wanted to maybe see about, I mean, function-wise, what do you need on the table to make sure both players can have a good time?
What was the first, we do this, I mean, I think I do this all the time, and I derail things slightly, but what was the terrain you started with? What terrain did, I started with water bottles and egg cartons.
It was a little bit different back in the day because there was, you could have a piece of felt or it'd be a forest and it blocked line of sight. Like there was no true line of sight. There was obscuring terrain and not obscuring terrain. And I'm actually not saying that you couldn't do that now. There's nothing stopping you from declaring that this piece of terrain is 5 inches tall or this piece of felt has these keywords. I'm not saying you're going to get the interactive experience that you're going to, you know, treasure for the rest of your life, but there's nothing stopping you from doing that at home. But when you want to raise it up to that, let's say you want to go 3D with it. We're going to not suggest pieces of felt on the terrain because, you know, it's just didn't feel good. What is the bare minimum past that? And Adam, to answer your question, foam, pieces of foam, egg cartons, carved foam for insulation, you know, stacked and then carved insulation foam from the hardware store. And you can actually make buildings and things like that. And also, what's the foam core board? Used to cut them up into ruined buildings and put them on, you know, mount them also on more foam core board to give them a little bit of stability. And then beer
bottles. That sounds way better than mine.
Yeah.
Does anybody else? I remember buying my first G-Dub primer, which was most of my money back then. And over discovering like that it dissolved styrofoam, packing styrofoam in a really awesome way, and I wasted the whole bottle on it. the whole thing. I didn't undercoat anything with that. I was just like, oh my god, dissolves it like acid.
And that lesson so you learned was it's a pre-internet lesson that I think everyone learned.
I regret nothing. It was freaking cool.
Yeah. Then you can get foam tolerant sprays. Remember that if you need to in the future.
Yeah. So I'm trying to think. My brother and I, when we kind of got in at the same time, I mean, a while back, I'm pretty sure we used aquarium terrain.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I mean, you go to Petco or PetSmart or whatever, and there's some stuff that's pretty good to scale. We picked up a bunch of like Roman, you know, Hellenic columns and like Pantheon, Colosseum kind of stuff. And so that was like our first foray into it. And then I remember us picking up also like wooden birdhouses that were like little castle things or whatever. And so like between those two, we kind of were able to make our first like fourth, fifth edition Warhammer tables using some of that stuff. And it was aesthetic enough, you know, I mean, as I'm sure you're familiar with different aquarium terrain stuff. I mean, it's at least painted and ready to go.
Sometimes that stuff is expensive, but there's always like the discount, the bargain stuff or whatever. And it's with a decent paint job, it will probably work just fine.
Yeah, exactly.
Same with the plants too. Like if you're getting foliage, there's some higher end aquarium foliage. Like don't do that. Go to the next aisle over. You might get some better deals for you because you're gonna paint it anyway. Budget. Like you don't care if it's, you know, like what degree of fish tank safe it is. You're probably going to prime and paint it and make it look completely different and chop it up and stuff. Like you don't have to get the highest quality stuff.
Yeah, agreed. I don't know about you guys, but I have a couple of different tables worth of terrain. And the first one I bought was actually when the new Sector Imperialis, the Sector Mechanicus terrain came out, all the stuff on all the raised girders and stuff.
Yeah.
Which was hilarious because I bought that like when it came out in 8th edition. And in 8th edition, it was like non-functional. It was so bad because like, nothing blocked line of sight. All right, cool. I'm standing behind this girder. Guess I'm dead. It was pretty bad. We had to make our own rules for it, but we did, and it became pretty functional by the end. By the time we figured out what kind of different rules we needed to attach to it, and I can tell you that stuff was really intimidating. I mean, the reason it was so intimidating is because G-Dub really upped their terrain game with that stuff. Like it went to another level when that stuff came out, and it was intimidating to paint a whole table of it set out. So I think I've got somewhere in the region of 20 pieces of that terrain, including a bunch of Promethean pipes to make that table.
It's and so man, good,
I was
though.
Actually, oh, it's phenomenal. It's some of the best terrain out there, I think, on the market, anywhere you can buy. But and I'm a big fan of it now that it's done. But man, when I was doing it, I was like, do you know those big silos they've got? I was really worried the paint wouldn't look flat because I was painting them yellow. And bulk yellow, getting bulk yellow to sit flat without an airbrush, because this was pre-Atom airbrush. It was scary. So I can feel for some people out there.
Well, so but going kind of back to the core of the question is, like, where do you start with terrain? I think you've really got to look at it as, like, what blocks line of sight. Like, you want to create lanes of fire. You want to create bases. You want to create... You may want to create a scenic or narrative view to things.
Yep.
I think you have to just kind of decide what's important to you. If you're going past just function of the game, you got to decide what's important to you and then build towards that. And that's going to be different. You know, if you want good for pictures, you want everything to be to match your bases, you know, which is fair. I'm not being dismissive of that. That is actually a really cool thing, especially if it's in your house and people come over to play with your armies. But I think to make the game function, you have to do it a little bit more objectively, and you need lanes of fire. You need things that will block off sections of the table that make good emplacements for objectives that make it to where, you know, any unit can hold it and stuff. And it normally comes down to just creating lanes of fire. Like, if you look at the Nova Open, like, their original terrain layout was very much based around just having symmetry on both sides of the table, so there was no clear advantage to one player or another. Now, this led to, like, people making army lists that would benefit from the terrain. So absolute symmetry is not always cool, but if you were starting out, that's a good place, I think, to start, is symmetry between how the halves or the quarters of the table line up. If you look at how the LVO did it this past year, where they had, you know, one table layout for if you were playing on the long table edge. They had a different table if you're a different, you shifted things slightly if you were playing on the corners or the shorter table edges. You know, so think about that when you're designing your initial terrain. Is it functional and modular to be able to give both players a good experience no matter what the deployment type is?
And I think more than, say, with armies, I think it's important to set a budget with terrain, because these things can blow out horrifically.
That may determine your materials list. You're exactly right.
So yeah, and like set your boundaries. Like, I want to get X pieces of terrain for this table, and I want, you know, certain ones to be bigger. I mean, like, building bigger pieces of terrain is something you can do yourself. Maybe we should do a whole segment on that, building your own terrain and where to get started there, because that's a very deep pool.
Let me tell you, I own a Fortress of Redemption, and I put it on every table all the time. Just as terrain, it's not. I mean, I don't take it as in my army or whatever. But
I mean, I gotta say, you know, there's such a wide range of terrain out there, whether it's 3D printed or the MDF stuff or the GW material. I mean, that's, you know, you mentioned the Fortress of Redemption. My brother Chris and I mean, we've been collecting terrain because we want to be able to essentially take it, you know, and offer it, be able to provide for people at events, be able to say, like, hey, we've got terrain, you know, if you guys want to use it for an event. So we have like a whole table, which is just the Fortress of Redemption with bastions, with the Wall of Martyrs and all of the, you know, Aegis defense lines and all that kind of stuff. And so it's like a full deal. But on the same, you know, on another table, we've got, we've taken, you know, some of these MDF buildings and kind of hobbied it into the terrain piece that we built. And we actually had a good friend of ours, Trent Mosley, who helped us build it all up. And I think, Adam, you're right. I think that would be a wonderful topic to really go into more detail of just some of the tricks of the trade, I guess, into how you can throw your own terrain on there and get it going. Because you really do, I mean, you kind of appreciate your own little collection of terrain. You know, if your friends are coming over, you're going over to their place and you have this different, you know, some variance over time. Again, it's absolutely a long-term effort.
Yeah, and packaging, you know, we're ordering lots and lots of things online right now. Sometimes those packaging can, with just a little bit of work, can turn itself into some terrain.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, how many of each piece, like, how many of each type of terrain do you think, like, the average beginner should accumulate?
I think like, that first, that's a great question because it's an important thing to think about. Just like Paul was talking about on the layout of the table, it's very important. You know, when you're considering large pieces, complex pieces, smaller pieces, little barrier. Because I mean, this is not eighth edition where you can just throw out all the. I mean, there are plenty of tables now that I've seen a lot of obstacles. You know, little walls and things like that. And GW's marketing and selling those kind of barriers and what. So those are totally a thing. Tanya, I think that's a great question. I mean, what do you guys think in regards of numbers for the beginner table?
So you can kind of look at the terrain sets that GW offers, and I think that's a good place, like the number of them. I think you need at least two central buildings of some kind that meet the requirements to block line of sight. The 5 inches, I mean, you know, the ones that then and then are large enough, and I'm talking about, you know, maybe the profile of them at the base is, you know, nine inches a foot, you know, or something. Mm-hmm. Maybe a good place to start. So two of those at least. And those don't have to necessarily be in the center. They could end up being, you know, you could position them to be bases, you know, on the side. And mm-hmm. then some degree of 3 to 4 other pieces that are in that. I would consider those to be the largest. So 2 large, 3 to 5 mediums, and then 2 or 3 smalls.
I like to include one piece, at least one piece on the table that is like light cover or the dense cover, the -1 to hit or whatever. Mm-hmm. I just think that it like adds a little bit to the game. I feel like when a table is missing that for me, I'm like, oh, it's a little bit less fun now.
Sure.
No, what do you throw in there, like forests?
Terrain's a big deal.
I like forests. Yeah.
Yeah, I think forests could fit into that 3 to 4, you know, or 3 to 5 pieces of medium type terrain.
Sure. And honestly, you know, in a lot of cases, forester, if you want to go aesthetically, I mean, they're actually pretty cheap to come up from, you know, Hobby Lobby or Michaels or something like that, and just getting train forest trees to put on a flat piece. If you even want to go that far, even a flat piece just starting off as you're getting going is enough to say, like, this is the start. You know what I mean?
Burned out trees, like some of the best trees I've ever gotten were from a after Halloween sale.
You know, nice.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's like all these people make these little Halloween villages and stuff, like in Christmas villages and things like that. You know, sometimes you can find some gems in those collections.
For forests, I like to take like the MDF bases, like the large ones. Like there's one size that's like bigger than the knight base, isn't there? Maybe not.
I think, but like, you can buy the biggest like base.
Is it the biggest one?
I think.
Well, whatever one's the biggest one, I get like the MDF sort of bases, and then I build it up with like flock and the terrain, aquarium plants that you were talking about before, yep. And then even just like spraying them, like you can do like a darker green and then hit it from the top with like a lighter green. Even that sometimes with a wash, good to go. Looks awesome.
So I guess you're having that be that fill those middle tiers things, or is that just kind of like the smaller scatter terrain?
I do it on scatter as well.
Okay.
Yeah. You can use the smaller bases for that too.
Oh, I like that.
I always have those MDF bases on hand. They just come in handy.
Yeah. They're durable. They give you something to build up from. That's for sure. That's actually a good point, because I'm actually mount all terrain on some kind of base.
I like to do that too, because then it kind of stops any arguments at the table. Like, oh, well, where does the terrain actually benefit me? Well, you have to touch the base of the terrain, right?
Yeah, right. That's a good point. And yeah, it provides a function and looks better and gives strength to your construction. And then you reduce arguments.
Yep.
What's not to like?
Mm-hmm.
MDF, you get it. You can get it pretty inexpensively from any hardware store. And even even the thinnest stuff on the larger sheet, like if it's a 2x2 sheet, it may look like it's bending a bit or whatever. But once you cut it down to the size you actually need for Warhammer game terrain, it's pretty flat and durable. So don't think you have to go for the thick MDF.
No, I use the fairly thin stuff.
Yeah. So that's where I would start. And look, terrain is a journey. So I think, like Adam, I think you mentioned setting limits on what your budget is. And if your budget is unlimited, then get whatever you want. And then, it can be an additional amount of effort to paint things because you've spent all this time on your miniatures. Maybe you don't want to spend all that time on your terrain. But I will say that most of the, like the molded plastic terrain holds up to dry brushing really well.
Yeah.
People aren't as expecting it. Like they, like between us, they're not expecting the terrain to be amazing. So you get a lot of leeway on expecting what the expectations of what the terrain is painted.
I just want to suggest too that like if you're making terrain and this is like a new thing for you, don't go into it thinking like your first set of terrain is going to be like this fantastic, like award-winning thing that everybody is going to think is beautiful. I would go into it and approach it like, I'm going to make this thing. I'm going to try my best. But I'm going to go into it making it functional first.
Yeah, that's a great right? tip.
So that you can at least play with it. You can learn some stuff out of that first round of terrain, play with it, and then you can take what you learned, and then your second set of terrain is going to look like miles and above better than the first set.
Upgrade it. You've cobbled together this abysmal looking pieces of foam to give you the line of sight blocking thing that you need to make the game fun. You know what? You can upgrade it whenever you're at the point that you want to with a building that looks that has the exact same shape.
Mm-hmm. I think as hobbyists, everyone has their dream table. But look, the dream table isn't always... And just like your dream car isn't the first car you buy, the dream table shouldn't be the first table you aim for.
Agreed. That's great. Yeah. That's the thing. What's your dream table? You might know it right offhand what their dream table is.
Zone Mortalis, the whole thing. Old. Yeah. I'm almost there. I've got like two-thirds of a table.
Like all the resin and stuff?
Yeah, baby.
Okay.
Well, the molded fiberglass.
All right. Tanya, you know what your dream table is?
I would probably like something that was like a huge ruined like building. Like almost the entire board was like one building that was a ruin that had like all these different giant chambers and stuff in it. And it all had like rubble and it was destroyed. I like snow. Like I love snow bases. So I'd want it to be like a wintry kind of scene. And that would probably
the roof is blown off and it's snowed into this massive, look, I'm not holding anyone to this. You can change your answer later if you want to. I'm asking you on the spot.
No, but for me, like, it's also my dream terrain because I feel like I could easily go and play like Frostgrave on it as well.
Cool.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Red, what you got?
Yeah, I think I'm kind of with Tanya's direction. Don't get me wrong. I love especially the new Necromunda stuff. And I've seen some amazing work that people have put together with these multi-stacked underhive kind of layouts together. But I really think like a blown out, like, I mean, massive cathedral, right? Like most of the level is like the kind of this cathedral like look, I think would be really cool.
I don't know what my dream table is, and I'm just not a cop out. I'm going to answer, but I'm not sure. It changes, I think. It is as often as I write a new army list, for the most part.
Ye be a fickle beast, Paul.
Well, but I also kind of think that I would like about a 100 of those armored containers and make the entire terrain be like it's in a rusted out shipyard, almost like an 80s action movie. I'm pretty sure that half the 80s action movies would always end up at a rusted out shipyard, so maybe that's why it's in my head.
I love it.
I think that would be really neat. But I don't know. I mean, seeing some, you know, you go and you see these amazing realmscapes at like Warhammer World or whatever, and you think, oof, I want to play on that. You know, there's this one cool, and it's like, it's a smaller one, kind of off by itself, at least, well, I don't know where it is now, but it's like a bombed out city, like most Warhammer things are, but there's like broken windows and it looks like somebody's overseeing is a parade, like if I'm remembering this right, like a parade of Imperial Guard. You know, there's a Marine overseeing this. It's like this is their victory lap after maybe an incredibly hard fought campaign type thing. And there's just all these narrative elements to it, and everything is choreographed and made. You know, that's, you know, again, if you could figure it out to where you're always having a diorama type battle, a narrative battle, while is being as cutthroat and competitive as I want to be, you know, that's, make that into a table. That's what I want. I mean, that's, you know, and it changes. But I think the rusted out shipyard, Blood Angels, I mean, you know how I was going to say it, but, you know, Fortress, you know, that kind of thing. Where everything
is. Have you guys ever like read a piece of Black Library literature and like been like, it was just described so well, like a big battle that you've wanted to like recreate that in terrain?
Most of them.
Yeah. Well, for me, the ships, when they're describing like their battles through some of the giant battleships, I mean, the authors do such a great job of making the ships themselves a character in the story. Like, I want to battle through that ship.
So, challenge to whichever Forge World, all of Forge World's watching this show. What are we talking about? But Siege of Terra. Is there going to be a Siege of Terra table at Warhammer World?
Oh, man. I can't wait. I cannot
bring
wait.
It.
They've done that before. So decades ago at this point.
Yeah, I remember.
Yeah, one of the games days was, you know, they had the Siege of Terra. I mean, it was, the pictures are cool. They're worth looking at. I mean, they're nowhere near today's technology, but they're really freaking cool.
I mean, even the Betrayal of Kallus table they had a while ago was just amazing.
Yeah. Oh
my gosh. I can't even imagine.
Is that the one where you had to find the assassin on it?
Yes. Yeah. And the, like, just the flood of word bearers versus all the Ultramarines, it looks so good.
They flubbed it, man. That is rolling a one in your D20. What happened to Kalf?
If someone like changed your like whatever role you had to a one for you, yeah, I guess so.
Yeah, so I'm confident.
I don't know. I don't know if we answered the best of our ability, the terrain question, but I think you do. You've got to. I think we all kind of came about it and got there is that. You know, figure out what your level of effort / budget is and then figure out what function you're trying to achieve and then do that and then replace the things over time with if you want to pro it up. Like I think, you know, some of the battle mats and stuff that you can get, like that's one way to like really pro up your game experience.
I'm a junkie, your
playability.
I have so many.
Yeah. Yeah. And then the terrain's an extension of that. Like, and then it's a hobby extension too. Like if you've got your one army done, you know, and sometimes something that's not your army, like you do a unit of dudes or, you know, tank or something, and then a palate cleanser, a piece of terrain or something. Or heck, let's say we get back, we're playing in tournaments and you get second place in an RTT and you get $50 worth of store credit or something. Pick up a piece of terrain if you've already got everything for your army. There's all kinds of different ways you could do this thing. But figure out what your level of involvement. I don't want to say lower your expectations, but be kind to yourself as you're going through that terrain journey because, again, these don't make zappy zappy pew pew noises. You get the same like visceral experience, I don't think, from getting them on the table, but it is rewarding and worthwhile. Plan a budget. Plan a function. Be kind to yourself with about the time it takes you to get it done, and then don't think you've gotta, you know, crack out the Sistine Chapel on your first go.
Mm-hmm. It's just got to be functional to start.
That's it. But the next thing is like when to splurge. I wasn't, you know, before the break, I mentioned that I bought that Winsor & Newton Series 7 brush. You hear people talk about them all the time. And I'm one of those painters. I need the help. Like I need the products to help me get to a better threshold. And
do you though?
I certainly feel like I do. Okay, I do not take care of my stuff very well. Like, but I'll use a brush until like the bristles have turned your all. It looks like a mangy dog by the time I'm done with it.
Yeah, that's why I use cheap synthetic brushes because then I spent 25 cents on it. I use it. I don't care about it. And
no,
then
the proof's in the pudding. You got beautiful stuff, and so I. And
oh, thank you.
I know other like incredibly talented painters that do the same thing. You know, I've messaged them in the past, like, yo, what brushes should I get? I want to paint like you. What brushes should I get? And they send me this link to the like 9 brushes for $1.75. I'm like, what?
Yeah.
And I've purchased them. I bought them thinking, you know, maybe, you know, what do I know? And turns out, no, I was not good with those things.
Yeah. I mean, I think maybe that's the problem is like you want to paint like them, but you need to maybe like paint like you. You know,
that's a fair point.
Right. And I think in order to do that, sometimes you need to like not watch the tutorials and sometimes you just need to buy a bunch of stuff and like try the stuff and see what works for you. Because literally what works for me is like the exact same setup that works for me is not going to work for anybody else but me. Do you know what I mean?
I think I do for sure. I counsel people when they're watching tutorials as well to like if they're using a big old brush and seemingly doing really well with it and you can't, then don't do that. And the same goes in reverse too. Like you have to get something that you're comfortable with or you understand how that paint works or that product or something. You know, it's like it's important. You know, we create these weird barriers for ourselves to progress. And
yeah,
sometimes they are just constructs.
To like tutorials and stuff like that, I sort of look at it like a tutorial is there so that I can take the parts that speak to me and I can just leave everything else, right?
I agree. Yep.
A tutorial isn't necessarily there for you to be like, I'm going to do every single step and it's going to look exactly the same as their finished product. Well, maybe. I mean, try all those steps, but maybe steps 1 and 4 didn't work for you. So you throw those ones away and you just take the ones that work for you.
I'm a habitual at that. It's like, oh, that's sweet that you put all them layers on that. I'm just going to go with with this and that. And,
yeah.
And be done.
Yeah. I like the idea. Like, I have a very stylized way of painting. A lot of people don't like it, and I get a lot of criticism for it. But it works for me, and I really like it. And I've only created it because I've just taken what I liked and threw away the rest. That's literally my entire philosophy with painting.
That's amazing.
That is awesome. I'm going to report back. I've not tried the Winsor & Newton Series 7 brush yet, but I will by the next show.
I'm really interested to see what your thoughts are on it.
Yeah, I use a lot of GW brushes, but I'm not like a complete brush loyalist. I've come accustomed to how some brushes behave, and where the reason that I got it was because was pretty good belief that it will hold its point longer, and I would like to get better. I kind of fight with myself as the longer I hold on to the brushes of like, oh, I need to paint this area, I need to paint around the shoulder pad, but I know I got those two rando bristles that stick out. So I got to hold my brush in a certain way where those rando bristles don't betray me.
I trim them off.
I clip them, yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. That is the thing with cheap brushes, is that sometimes they come with those rando bristles straight out of the package. So you just clip those ones off and you're good to go.
Well, I struggle with doing things like painting eyes and stuff like that. So again, I don't believe that the product or is like a miracle. Well, you still have to do the work and the effort, but I'm led to believe that it might be easier to achieve some of the things that I want with this particular style of brush. And I'm going to report back. I'm going to try it and report back.
I have a really easy way of doing eyes if you want a tutorial.
Oh, wow. I'll take any help we can get.
Okay. Yeah. Yep. Get at me after the show.
Yeah. So one of the... I've asked painters before, how do you paint eyes? The response was, don't. Which I can respect. Like, you don't really need to on your rank and file troops. You don't have to. Look. Actually, you don't have to do anything with your paints or your models. It's do whatever true. You want. Yeah, but I'm just.
It's true. Yeah. I'm just looking at my orc boys that all have they have gas masks on, so they all have painted lenses with like 4 different layers in them, and orc boys.
There you go.
They die right away.
Yeah. They come in the dustpan, they leave in the dustpan.
Exactly.
That's, I know we didn't get too heavy into the FAQ in the first part of the show, but there were, I think we got with the big gameplay changes, the things that may actually influence the win and loss of a game, felt like we got there.
We hit broad strokes. Very broad strokes. There's probably some more stuff that hasn't even been figured out yet. People haven't realized it's impactful.
We got to play some games. So
that's right, man.
Yeah. So this thing about terrain, it's a different thing for everybody. But my personal advice though is to get what works to make the game fun, and then build everything up from that.
Mm.
And if all you need is a couple of pieces of foam stuck together, to make that happen, you can get that. On the cheap, like that doesn't have to be a giant expenditure for you, but you need to spend some time thinking about what's going to make the game fun for you and your opponent, and then beauty it up from there. And then look, with this brush, I'll report back, and I want to be amazed, I want to be wowed, but look, we'll see. I also have shackled by my own limitations, but we'll see how that goes. I'm actually pretty proud of how my most recent squad of Assault Intercessors is coming out. Nice. I've taken some very close-up pictures of them and posted them online, almost as so I can go revisit them later. I don't advise that you take those kind of close-up pictures, because you get to see how hard you didn't thin the paint.
Photography tip, never use the onboard flash when you're taking pictures of your minis. Just trust me on this one.
That is true. So coming up at the end of the month, we have the Las Vegas Nopen. Myself and Adam will be doing commentary across multiple games from multiple streamers. Please join us for that. You purchase some merch The profits for that merch is going directly to charity, where we're going to be have raffles and giveaways. And we will be doing, if you post like with our hashtag during the broadcast, we're going to be giving something away. I don't know what it is yet. Something cool. Yeah. And then if you might get up like a bonus entry or stuff, if you're actually wearing some of the merch in those posts. The shirt is very cool.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just really freaking keen to watch some games, commentate some games.
Well, games between like competent players, like good players, people that are spending a lot of time figuring out, you know, what to put in their list, things that they would have brought to the big tournament, the big show, if we were able to have it.
Exactly. It's going to be interesting, especially like now this FAQ really does turn things on their heads. I think I probably, well, I've seen the list. I know you've seen the list as well, but I reckon if I was guessing, we would have got it pretty close to being spot on pre-FAQ, but now the FAQ's really turned a couple of things on their heads and made things pretty spicy, which I'm really keen for.
I don't want to spoil we're going to publish all the lists. You'll be able to see what everyone is playing. And then it's important to know that the list are the going to be the ones that filter down through the brackets. Like the list are going to travel and the list may. So we'll be both showcasing the players and the lists and the missions and then just celebrating the hobby. Being nostalgic about our time at the LVO and, you know, wishing we could all be there. And we may have some special guests, you know, if we can get them in on the show as well. You know, this is something we're really looking forward to doing.
Yeah, I can't wait.
Yeah, it's going to be great. Well, thanks for listening, everybody out there, about the terrain. Really appreciate everybody tuning in.
Me too, man. Yeah. Had a great time.
Make my day.